You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, I'm David Kleon. I'm a freelance journalist. Fun fact, I actually used to work for Blogging Heads and have set up a lot of these dialogues. Recently I've written for The Guardian and Gothamist. My last real job was for Al Jazeera America, rest in peace, last year. I'm here at the invitation of Robert Wright, who runs the site, to speak with Michael Tracy. Michael, why don't you introduce yourself?
I am a journalist now based in Los Angeles. I am a reporter for TYT Politics, which is a subdivision of the Young Turks, the online news network. I've done a few of these with Bob Wright in the past, and I've also written journalism for a wide variety of outlets, actually including for the Young Turks, where I'm sort of spearheading their initiative to get a foothold into written reporting in addition to video reporting, which is what they are mainly known for.
Gotcha. And I should say, actually, I'm recording this out of Brooklyn, New York, so we are doing the Brooklyn-Los Angeles chat, which is just kind of right over the heartland, where I know, Michael, you've done a fair amount of reporting. But
yeah, I have. So we are forsaking the flyover country in the process of conducting this conversation. That seems pretty evident.
Regardless, I think we've both spent a fair amount of time between the coasts and are not completely ignorant of it. But
I was just in West Texas.
Oh, wow.
A few days ago. So far out into West Texas that there actually is no cell phone service, which was pretty surprising to me because it's a sparsely populated area and it's rural, but there are still some people there, and yet it's not a given that you can get any cell phone service there. So the congressman whose town halls I was covering actually remarked that his chief of staff was flipping out in the car because, you know, for the first time in recent memory, she was not able to access her email, so she's having a bit of a nervous breakdown. So that was sort of funny.
Actually, before we jump into the main thing we were going to talk about, because you were in Texas, this just reminded me, I did want to ask you, and feel free to decline because I know maybe you might be writing something up about it, but I think there is a lot of curiosity on Twitter about your recent encounter with Kurt Eichenwald.
Yes.
In Texas? In Dallas, right?
In Dallas, yeah. Dallas. Well, Kurt Eichenwald is in.
Well, first of all, could you just say for anyone who might not know who Kurt Eichenwald is, why there's interest, and then, yeah, just what was the nature of your recent encounter with him?
Well, Kurt Eichenwald is an object of fascination to me and to many people on the internet for a multitude of reasons.
I disagree.
One of which is that he has a pretty robust Twitter presence that tends to be, let's say, animated or excited. And
didn't he once say he knew judo or something or some martial art and or his son did and he threatened some trolls? I don't know.
It's very possible.
I don't follow him, but
he's always getting into skirmishes with trolls that end up taking amusing turns, and he's always sort of making dramatic declarations of one kind or another. So just by happenstance, and he's a writer for Newsweek now, and when I use the word Newsweek, I'm not even sure what I'm referring to anymore, because
right.
Newsweek that presently exists doesn't seem to bear much relation to the Newsweek that most people tend to know. So I happened just to be in the Dallas area. Like I said, I had been in West Texas, and which is, around Dallas, this past week, doing a totally unrelated story. Somebody told me that Kurt Eichenwald had been advertising that he was going to be holding a home liquidation sale.
Huh.
So I figured, by some act of divine grace, I happened to be poised to attend this home liquidation sale. And I know plenty of people on Twitter would have seized that opportunity if it was available to them as well. So I figured, why not? I went over and I kind of went through all his... I just looked through all the personal effects that were on sale in his home. It was pretty bizarre.
Did he know who you were?
He did not initially know who I was. After we had spoken for a while he became aware of who I was.
Uh-huh. Let me say actually a brief thing for anyone who doesn't already know, who's watching this, about social media. So I know about Michael largely through Twitter, where both of us spend a lot of time. Michael has at least 10 times as many followers as I do. But I'd like to think we both have meaningful followings. And Michael probably knows who I am because I troll him a lot. I'm neither going to...
I admire your honesty on that front.
No, I'm a very honest person, actually. I'm not going to specifically apologize for that on video, but we did agree beforehand that we were going to try to have a civil conversation here, and we will try. But
and in the past, I just wanted to know, you know, that I've actually invited you, you know, in response to your repeated trolling. Which can't be described as anything but trolling, which it is. And sometimes trolling has utility, so I don't necessarily begrudge you for that. I actually invited you to do a video dialogue. I actually suggested on YouTube, but Blogging Heads, you know, just as well. But you actually declined for various reasons having to do with possibly incurring the wrath of trolls. So
yeah, well,
change of heart you might have experienced, I commend you for.
Let me say a word about that, because actually, I guess we should talk about this first before we get into the politics of the day. But I did want to talk a little about social media and Twitter specifically, since you and I do spend so much time there. And since I think certainly anyone who follows me and maybe some people who follow you are aware that, you know, we have this little feud that I started going on. I the reason I declined, this is absolutely true, Michael, after I think you blocked me for a while, but then said I had been put in timeout and that was over now. And then you slid into my DMs, as they say, and invited me to record a chat, not on Blogging Heads, but just on your, you know, on your personal channel, I guess. And I thought about it, but I did decline. And the main reason I declined was because of a critique that I have of you on social media that I'd be interested in hearing your take on, that I know I'm not the only person who has, and not the only person who's raised with you, which is that among your, how many followers would you say you have now? Like 60,000, something like that.
I think it's like 67,000 something.
Sure.
Not 100%. I could check if you want. We could fact check.
It's fine. It's
in that area.
Which is a significant following. Among them, there seem to be an awful lot of people who might be characterized as alt-right or some people would use terms like anime Nazis or Pepes, referring to the frog cartoon that a lot of them use. Or just avowed Trump supporters, which I don't want to conflate with those because obviously over 60 million people voted for Donald Trump. But there does seem to be among his most enthusiastic supporters online some connection to that world. And since I know you didn't endorse Donald Trump last year, in the end, I looked it up recently, you endorsed neither candidate, neither major candidate. You endorsed not voting, I think. But nonetheless, you do seem to have this large following. And the critique that I and some others would make is that while I have no idea what percentage of your 60,000+ followers they make up, anytime anyone interacts with you, you know, we suddenly come in for a lot of attacks from them. And I know you would not say some of the things they're saying, some of which are grotesquely racist or anti-Semitic or whatever, or abusive, But people like that do seem to follow you, and I have not noticed you make any conscious attempt to brush them off. Although you have expressed opinions they might not agree with, what would you say to anyone, including me, who might criticize you for that?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a critique that I've been dealing with now for months, probably since last summer, mm-hmm. when you know the campaign season really picked up and. Attention was heightened around the election. And what I had done was I basically determined that in terms of a journalistic or analytical beat, what would be most efficacious for me would be to focus on the Clinton campaign. Now, that's not to say that I didn't report or comment on Trump. I did voluminously. And I actually did some stories on Trump that I'm not sure were actually reported elsewhere. But I think it's fair to say that if there was a focus that I developed in that period, it was on the, let's say, inconsistencies or contradictions in the Clinton campaign, and also that extended to the liberal critique of Trump, which I identified as also having some inconsistencies and even hypocrisies in some respects. So it's not surprising to me that, having garnered a following during that period, a portion of them are people who were hostile to Hillary for other reasons, or reasons that only tangentially, if at all, overlap with the reasons that I was espousing. But I should also mention, you know, I didn't just decline to endorse Trump or Clinton. I stated opposition to both of them. I mean, I wrote an entire post for my personal Medium on October 12th, entitled "Why I Do Not Support Trump,"
right, I remember,
in which
that.
I said that I oppose Trump, and that I actually, and that his presidency could, quote, easily result in bad outcomes and even potential catastrophes. So, the idea that I was ambivalent about
I think we can agree now that that particular prediction has been at least partly vindicated by events now.
Right, and I think there are definitely some events that have transpired that could be characterized that way. But you know, we can talk about that more. But what I want to just say in response to that critique, which is increasingly prevalent now on social media, is that I have to just dispute the premise that a person who has, you know, a relatively sizable online following should be in any way held culpable for the actions of people over whom they exert no control, or nor would they want to exert control. So I don't want to have any kind of micromanagement over my Twitter following, and that's just self-evidently absurd. So the idea that I should be made to account for the actions of just random trolls on the internet, I mean, not long ago that would have been seen as obviously preposterous, but now it's gotten to a point where it seems to color or animate a huge portion of online critiques of people's work. You know, I want to be held to account only for what I say and write and do. And that just can't include the actions of just random people online, because inevitably that's a hugely slippery slope, and it's actually fallacy. It's like there's the guilt by association fallacy is, if you espouse a view that also happens to be espoused by somebody who is contemptible, that makes you somehow in league with the contemptible person.
Sure.
That fallacy has been extended such that the association can be asserted between you and people who happen to click the follow button on your Twitter account.
Okay, and so fair enough. And I'll say right now, I certainly would not want to be held accountable for every one of my 5,000 plus followers either. I mean, I'm sure some of them have said or done terrible things, and I don't accept responsibility for that. But I will say there are a few things. Well, there are two main responses I have to what you just said. And I want to make clear, first of all, and notwithstanding certain colorful language I've used in the past, I'm sure you are not, in fact, a fascist or a Nazi or an anti-Semite. At least I hope not. But
gee, thanks.
Yeah. Well, no. And I know that that's not the message you're putting out there. But I think there are sort of two responses I have. First, and this, by the way, was why I declined the initial invite, because I was concerned. Because in the past, when I've talked to you and when I've talked to certain other people, some of whom are avowedly alt-right. Like there was a guy, Ricky Vaughn, who I had to block. There was Kurt Schlichter. Some of these guys, I'll have like one interaction with them, or they'll quote tweet me once, and suddenly there are hundreds of anime Nazi trolls in my mentions. And I've taken a personal policy that I'm satisfied with of blocking these people on site. Like if I see one account with deplorable in the name or whatever, it's just gone, blocked immediately. That may be a way to further cocoon myself, but, you know, it also speaks to, you know, why I use Twitter and the interactions I want to have and don't have. I think my following broadly defined, which is not really large enough to, you know, to even inadvertently launch troll armies on people. I should say also, okay, if you have a large following, and you do, I would argue that while obviously there's no law or Twitter company policy saying this, that just as a matter of reality in terms of how Twitter works, when you have a large following and you interact with someone, including someone who doesn't necessarily have a large following, they almost invariably will end up talking to a lot of your followers. And people do develop reputations based on who their followers are. I mean, as I'm sure you've seen, for instance, when you talk to someone like, I don't know, Peter Dow, who I'm sure neither of us is a fan of.
Well, just to interject very briefly, I mean, do you acknowledge the fallacy of people developing a reputation based on the actions and words of their followers rather than on the substance of what they've actually written or tweeted?
I'm not sure that I do. I'm not saying that you set out to do this or that it would be easy to manage this reality, but I'm saying there is nonetheless a reality that I think people do incur some responsibility to manage, and this is across the board. I mean, I think if you're like a pro-Hillary, Blue Nation type person like Peter Dow, and you have tens of thousands of followers who some of whom probably are bots, other of whom behave like bots, and just kind of go around harassing everyone who doesn't worship the ground Hillary Clinton walks on, and you and I both know that's a real thing. I think there is some responsibility. I think you. Every single follower you have, but if it's something that routinely happens, where hundreds of followers, all like-minded, sort of gang up on anyone who talks to you, that probably is something you could take some steps to ameliorate.
I think it would be ridiculous and unrealistic to expect Peter Dow to micromanage his following such that he could, in any real sense, minimize, you know, the adverse consequences of his Twitter following. And likewise,
in Peter Dow's case, I think this is exactly what he wants. I think this is
maybe I don't know. I mean, I would,
is,
I would,
but yeah.
I would, you know, not I, I'm not eager to get inside his brain. But I mean, whenever people have presented me with this critique, I always ask them, what do you suppose I should do? Should I spend literally hours a day individually vetting everybody who follows me on Twitter and then blocking them when it seems like they have unsavory views? I mean, it's just a totally unrealistic expectation, and yet it's used as a cudgel for people on social media who don't actually want to address the substance of what the person who they're supposedly so angered by is actually saying.
Okay, well, this brings me to my second point I wanted to raise in response to what you said, which is
By the way, just to add, I mean, another aspect of the reality of how Twitter is constituted is that users have a pretty wide range of tools at their disposal to manage their individual experience. Like you mentioned, they can block people. There's these block lists that now are available to some. They can mute. They can even protect their account in an extreme circumstance. So there are plenty of steps that Twitter provides people so that they can customize their user experience.
Sure, and I'll grant you that. Of course, I think here's where I should, you know, just almost obligatorily say that we are two white men having this conversation, and it can be, progressively harder depending on which intersecting identities one has. I know, you know, prominent women of color, for instance, like Leslie Jones of Saturday Night Live, have faced some really horrific harassment, and of course their followings are on a scale where that's pretty hard to. You know, block everyone, and block lists are a real thing. But I mean, I've been caught up in block lists for no reason at all. Like they function on very simple algorithms. So anyway, but I did want to raise a second and maybe more substantive objection, although it ties into the first, to what you said, which is that not everybody has a large alt-right following, and it seems to me that while they may not perfectly reflect the opinions you've actually expressed, and I know the opinions you've actually expressed, and I know you're not Milo Yiannopoulos or whoever, but at the same time, insofar as you might attract some of the same followers that he does, it occurs to me that there might be something in the substance of how you're writing that does speak to them. Now, you said earlier you've written critically about Hillary Clinton. I should say so have I, and I've tweeted extensively critically about her, and so have many, many people I know who I believe share this basic critique I'm advancing. And I would put forward, but please feel free to push back after I do, that while you have written critically about Clinton and Trump, and you know, referring to a little exchange I had with Glenn Greenwald, who was sticking up with for you the other day, it's true that unless I'm wrong, you didn't literally refer to Trump as the peace candidate during the campaign, although maybe you did somewhere. If you did,
no, I absolutely did not. Okay. Despite the repeated suggestions of people who are just make that assertion with absolutely no basis whatsoever. Well, okay. And then when I push back and actually say to them that I never used that term, they always retreat into this pose of ironic detachment, which is so incredibly pervasive on Twitter, because they can't actually substantiate their accusations.
Okay, so let me be earnest and straightforward in what I think I'm trying to say. I believe, having followed you for most of the campaign or much of the campaign and since, and including some of your Medium posts and, you know, writings in various publications, that the general thrust of your coverage, and right up to that piece I mentioned earlier where you endorse not voting, has acknowledged the salient critiques of Trump for the most part, and certainly shied away from actually endorsing him. But that you've devoted the vast majority of your energy to attacking Hillary Clinton, and many of the individual attacks I might agree with. I agree, for instance, and in fact, Glenn Greenwald endorsed a tweet of mine recently saying that you know, that Hillary vindicated her left critics and discredited herself by endorsing Trump's strikes on Syria the other week, which I'm sure you agree with. And so I think we may agree on a lot of things about both candidates, but I feel that the thrust of your coverage was so overwhelmingly and viscerally hostile to her. I don't think it's unrealistic to say it was maybe 90% anti her and, you know, 10% or maybe perfunctorily anti him. And in
let me just respond, because
I mean, post election, yes, could you respond to that and maybe push back against it?
Yeah, well, I mean, the reason why, and I just acknowledged that the thrust of my coverage tended to be focused on the Clintons, although again, I have to stipulate that I did repeatedly talk about Trump in negative terms and highlighted his flaws for sure. But the reason that the thrust of my coverage during the campaign, by the way, not now, I mean, I haven't been focused on Hillary Clinton for the past number of months. I mean, every once in a while, something will come up that I comment on, but it's not been a focus by any stretch. But, you know, during the election, it's true that the thrust of my coverage tended to be focused on the Clintons. And that was because there was, and I would severely doubt that you would deny this, but there was overwhelming media conformity against Trump, to an unprecedented scale historically. And my what I discerned was that there was relatively little coverage of the dangers posed by Hillary Clinton, especially her extremely hawkish and blemished foreign policy agenda. So and so that was my focus, purely because there was an overwhelming torrent of daily coverage of Trump's flaws that I thought would benefit from a counterbalance by at least devoting, you know, a fair amount of energy in highlighting the problems and inconsistencies and even corruptive tendencies of the Clintons. So that was the reason for the thrust of my coverage. But
okay.
I mean, the inference that therefore means that I was in favor of Trump when I repeatedly stated opposition to Trump and outlined the reasons for that, including his volatility and the fact that his impulsivity could easily lead to very bad outcomes. I don't accept that that should be taken as some kind of indication that I was, you know, tacitly or implicitly in favor of Trump in any respect, because my own words on repeated occasions plainly contradict that. So, I mean, and just to quickly touch on a point that you raised earlier, which I didn't get to respond to, it's that, you know, there's perhaps some reason why, although I never stated support of Trump, that people who are ostensibly on the alt-right or whatever you want to characterize that internet subculture as found things to like in my writing. I mean, I don't know why that might have been the case. I mean, I constantly get reactions from people across the spectrum. The thing with the alt-right or with that group of that cadre of Twitter trolls is they have it. They make an extra effort to be visible, so they coordinate amongst themselves to make themselves known. That probably in a way that probably exaggerates their overall presence or impact. So it's not surprising to me that they would, that, you know, if people are just kind of like blithely looking through my Twitter replies on a random tweet, they might assume that the alt-right is just enthralled with my views. But I just, I mean, I, whenever I get, you know, favorable feedback from people, mostly they're on the left. They're just not ostentatious Twitter trolls. So they don't tend to inform people's perception or some people's perception of my disposition in the way that these, you know, alt-right kind of very vocal personalities maybe sometimes do.
Okay. Well, let me ask you maybe one or two more questions about your coverage, and then maybe we can switch to the day's events, and in particular the Russia scandal, which we had agreed to talk about, or lack thereof. But the one last thing I want to ask you first is, do you feel, I mean, I guess sort of a two-part question. First, your coverage in which you attempted to sort of balance what you saw as an overwhelming media bias against Trump and in favor of Clinton.
Do you agree that that existed?
Yeah, broadly. Although I not without reason, I would say, and also not terribly surprisingly, but sure, I think that's
Without reason, but it definitely did skew the tenor of the coverage.
Yeah, although hold on, I would be remiss, actually, if I didn't air what someone more enthusiastic about Clinton than myself might say with some decent points in there, which is that while it is undoubtedly true that almost everyone who works in media, is a Democrat, give or take, or certainly the vast majority are, and that their cultural biases would lead them to be more supportive of Clinton than of Trump. And that certainly includes virtually everyone I know in New York and Washington where I grew up. But that notwithstanding, I think people have raised some very plausible critiques about two media biases. One that was sort of in favor of Trump in the sense that CNN in particular saw that, you know, putting his uncut speeches on gave them, you know, huge ratings, so they gave him way more airtime than other Republican candidates starting in the primaries, and kind of made the narrative arc of the year about him and the rise of Trump. And so there was a way that even though he was portrayed as a buffoonish or bigoted figure, he was still in some ways the protagonist of the 2016 election, the anti-hero, if you will. And Hillary, for her part, was, you know, a lot of people have raised charges of sexism and how she was covered, which I don't think are entirely without merit, although I sometimes think they're overstated. People have also, I would say as a critic of the Clinton campaign that she and the people around her kind of engender this themselves by their relentless hostility toward media and sort of opaque attitude, but I would say that the tone of coverage toward her was often very hostile. In any case, the question I wanted to ask you was, I'm guessing like most people, maybe I'm wrong, and like, you know, most people on Wall Street too, you probably assumed all year that Clinton was going to win, which of course she did win the popular vote, and it still feels a little bit like a fluke that she lost. I think anyway, first of all, is that true? Did you think that? Second of all, if you did that affect the tenor of your coverage? Like if you had thought it was a genuine toss up or that Trump was the front runner, might you have covered the campaign differently?
Well, my position that I espoused all throughout the campaign was that I had a base level assumption that Trump's odds of victory were marginally higher than what the pundit consensus assumed.
Well, you deserve credit for that, I have to say. Not many people got that, but
yeah. So and by pundit consensus, I meant just the confluence of the, you know, mainline perception of polling data combined with all the kind of structural factors that are taken into account when assessing the odds of victory for a particular candidate. I always said that I thought Trump's odds of victory were probably 20 to 30% higher than what the pundit consensus had arrived at. So if Trump had a 10% odds of victory on any given day, my kind of just personal adjustment to that was always that he had a 40% chance of victory. So that ended up being borne out, I think. But it wouldn't have affected my coverage, because even on days when Trump was the underdog, so if he had a 5% chance to win, and he would, or if the pundit consensus was at 5%, and therefore with my adjustment it was at 35%, Hillary Clinton was still the front runner, and therefore, you know, critical coverage of her and illumination of her, say, deceptions and misleading statements and overall tarnished record, I think would be even more vital to emphasize, because she would be poised to become one of the most powerful person in the world. So
sure,
and the imbalance of coverage would have still been present. So I mean, I think it's true that, you know, people in cable news calculated and in internet news calculated that Trump was getting a lot of viewers and clicks, so it was actually profitable to place focus on him. But I think it's sort of indisputable that in the general election campaign, the tenor of coverage of Trump in media precincts was overwhelmingly negative.
I mean, but
on a regular basis.
Michael, let me ask though.
And that had.
Do you think it is unreasonable for coverage to be negative of a candidate who says and does the things I'm sure we don't have to rehash that Trump says and does? I mean, Trump was an unusually, I think, God, what's the word? They've all been used before, but I don't think it's, the media would have been remiss to cover some of Trump's, you know, very representative statements about minorities and women and so on, as if they were completely ordinary. I think that would have been a failure on the media's part.
Well, let me just complete the sentence. I think you could say it was justified to have the coverage skewed in such a manner and overwhelmingly weighted against Trump during the general election campaign, but the inevitable consequence of that, and I heard this from voters constantly all over the country, is that it sort of created this level of fatigue with Trump outrage that seemed to be churned out on a daily basis in the media, and that therefore made certain voters who maybe ended up voting for Trump, even if they didn't particularly care for him, that made voters sort of tune out the coverage of him that really did need to be conveyed, such as genuine harms he might have committed and genuine bad policies that he might have been promoting. So the point is that the result of this media imbalance, however justified it may have been, on a whole, resulted in a distortion of the coverage and a warped picture of what was actually going on. And my point was not that people should have more favorable coverage of Trump, or that what that was even warranted, is that they should be more circumspect and maybe more targeted and focused, rather than just this daily avalanche of outrage that had, I think, the function of just causing people to throw their hands in the air and kind of ignore it.
Well, I think I have a mixed response to that, because on the one hand, I think from everything I've read and everything I know about the sort of how the election played out and about the electorate, I think there is something to what you're saying about the sense among large parts of the country and among Trump's base of total cultural alienation from the media and its values and the way it covered the campaign. I don't think that's wrong. At the same time, the reality of what Trump was saying, which, you know, at this point, now that he's president, we kind of, I feel like we're almost inured to it. Like, we're almost just like, oh yeah, it's totally normal when the president, you know, lies constantly or, you know, threatens wildly irresponsible things or says incredibly bigoted things about vulnerable minorities. That's a totally normal thing. But I still, there are a lot of things the media did do wrong. And in particular, I think they probably, my own critique, which I'm guessing you would agree with, and I'm going to avoid naming names here, but among a number of mainstream liberal media outlets, I would say there was a lot of coverage, and frankly, it went back several years before Trump, before Bernie Sanders ran. I should say, in the interest of transparency, that I voted for Sanders in the primary, and I voted for Clinton in the general, and that probably tells viewers everything they need to know about my politics. But I want to say that my critique of kind of the liberal commentariat writ large, as opposed to the left commentariat, is that there was a lot of kind of kissing up to the Clinton campaign, some of which was probably directly access seeking, some of which was just, you know, reflexive. But I think giving them too much credit for knowing what they were doing and kind of working with the assumption that they were going to win, and then, you know, you would want to have personally, or you would want your outlet to be on good terms with the administration. And I think this led to some real blind spots, in particular about her strategy, which turned out to be a catastrophic strategy. And since, although I did, you know, vote for Hillary Clinton because I believe that for her many faults, very much including her hawkish foreign policy, that was the responsible thing to do, and that the country would be in much better shape right now if she had won, certainly on all domestic fronts. But even as I did, I you know, my friends who broadly supported Bernie Sanders or have more radical left politics, you know, I think we all saw a lot of things wrong with Clinton's history, her policies, and her general approach to campaigning that left us with a lot of anger and frustration, in addition to obviously fear and anxiety after election night. So I don't know if you have any response to that, but if you don't, we can switch to the Russia stuff.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think there was, you know, one of the reasons why I decided to situate the direction of my coverage, let's say, as I did during the campaign, was because it seemed that one of the trends that was vastly undercovered over the course of the campaign, and of course there are always exceptions here, so I'm just speaking in very general terms, was the fissures within the Democratic coalition. And I actually did a dive log with Bob Wright on just that in October of last year. So, you know, for the entirety of the Republican primary campaign, the focus was on how could Trump possibly reunite the Republican Party, look at these ideological divides that seem to be unbridgeable, and a lot of hand-wringing about that, which seemed to be in bad faith for the most part, while on the other hand, Hillary's failure to sufficiently court, let's say, progressives or leftists or whatever term you want to use, may have been her electoral downfall. And that dynamic seemed to get relatively scant attention during the campaign. So that's what I opted to cover and try to elucidate the reasons for. So that was one thing that I focused on, and it proved to be extremely relevant, because, you know, if she had maybe done a few better appeals to that disillusioned segment of the electorate, she could have carried Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania.
You know, it's interesting. I very much want to agree with that, because it flatters my own worldview and my own politics. But I feel like, to play devil's advocate a little bit, I know that in Wisconsin, even though she lost, she ran ahead of Russ Feingold, who was running to get his Senate seat back, who also lost. And Feingold is generally seen as one of the few national politicians who the left is somewhat favorable toward, Clinton much less so. And some supporters of Clinton have suggested that there's a little bit of wishful thinking on the part of the left in conflating, especially the kind of educated millennial left in conflating its own politics and its own priorities with those of the white working class in places like Wisconsin or Michigan. Now, you reported out of some of these Rust Belt states she was supposed to win and lost, right?
Yeah. I was in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and North Carolina. So not like the heart of the Rust Belt, but sort of, you know, on the periphery.
And I would say Pennsylvania and Ohio count. So what did in your experience reporting in small blue collar white towns? I mean, would you say that left, you know, it's of the sort of the type of people I would see at a Bernie Sanders rally in Greenwich Village, which is something I've actually attended. Would you say that that accurately describes the politics of people in places like those? I'm genuinely asking. I haven't done any reporting out there.
By the way, I also attended that Greenwich Village Bernie Sanders rally. Anyway,
we could have seen each other.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, there are different questions here that need to be separated or differentiated. So the white working class issue is something in its own right. I'm talking about ideological progressive voters, which I think might overlap in a narrow sense with the white working class in certain respects. But what I'm saying, her failure to win over the white.
Overwhelmingly, we're concentrated, at least I would think stereotypically, in kind of major urban areas and college towns.
But she could have ran up the margins in Madison, Wisconsin, and Philadelphia, and other places to a greater degree, which in a very tight election could have made a determinative difference. So I'm talking about ideological progressives which her campaign explicitly shunned. I mean, they courted so-called moderate Republicans. They touted the endorsement of national security hawks and these Republican operative types. After the Democratic convention, when they sort of threw a bone to so-called progressives, once that was over, her campaign radically shifted direction and basically wrote off the electoral utility of trying to court disaffected progressive voters. So the white working class issue is another question. I'm talking about the narrow sliver of the electorate, and it's not a huge portion of the electorate, that's for sure. But they do exist. They do tend to vote when they feel impelled to do so. And a lot of those people, some of whom voted for Bernie Sanders and would not transition to Hillary Clinton. One of the things that was undercover during the campaign was that a starkly high percentage of Bernie Sanders voters, according to polling data, did not relent in their hostility to Hillary Clinton and didn't end up voting for her. So, you know, in a narrow race, those people could have been determinative of the outcome. Now, maybe it was the case that their hostility to Hillary Clinton was so ingrained that any appeals that she made to them would have rung hollow, and it was just never feasible that she could have plausibly done that. And that speaks to just her inherent weakness as a candidate. But at the very least, my perception in talking to voters in these states, including younger voters who were incredibly disillusioned with Hillary, was that that dynamic was not receiving sufficient coverage. So that's why my analysis and reporting had the thrust that it did, or at least one of the reasons why.
Well, I agree with most of what you just said as far as the Clinton campaign's failures. I guess I would say, I guess last question before Russia then. Do you feel, given that Trump did in fact win, and given that, as you yourself have acknowledged online recently, the foreign policy he's carrying out now is basically what Ben Rhodes called the blob in D.C. would have wanted all along? Airstrikes on Bashar al-Assad, a hostile posture toward North Korea, actually, and we'll get to this in a sec, but a surprisingly hostile posture toward Russia, the use of Moab in Afghanistan. I mean, basically, so you didn't call him the peace candidate. Obviously, some people did, and I assume those people are shaking their heads right now because he seems to be wanting really aggressive wars on, I don't know, four or five different fronts right now. And he seems to have turned over most of his policymaking apparatus to generals who have a lot of bipartisan support, including from Hillary Clinton and John Kerry and people like that. So given that that's how things are shaking out, and what we seem to have is the D.C. hawk establishment on autopilot with Trump's full approval, do you feel like in retrospect, maybe you should have covered Trump a little more and with a little more and a little more aggressively? Like, do you feel like maybe, do you feel like you did your due diligence as a campaign reporter in terms of making it clear to your readers that this was a potential danger if Trump did defeat Flynn?
I mean, I think I'm comfortable with all my analysis and reporting over the course of the campaign. I mean, if I went back and reviewed a bit of it, you know, in preparation for this discussion, I see nothing that has been proven radically wrong. I mean, what I and others, including Greenwald, who you cited earlier, said repeatedly over the course of the campaign was that Trump evinced certain non-interventionist instincts. That doesn't make him an unflappable non-interventionist in every circumstance, nor could he be called the peace candidate. I mean, anybody who called him the peace candidate while he was pretty much every day bragging about how strenuously he was going to bomb ISIS was fooling themselves. So to use that term would have been ridiculous, and I never did. I don't know many people who actually did who have any kind of prominence. The problem is, you know, people tend to conflate, whether out of ignorance or cynicism, I'm not sure, the identification of Trump with certain strands of non-interventionism with this idea that he's a peacenik or that he is, you know, a dove, which is flatly absurd. I mean, Barack Obama also evinced certain non-interventionist instincts over the course of his campaign and presidency, but he evinced interventionist instincts in other respects.
Right. Well,
and I think the same is true of Trump. I mean, the point in
let me just finish the thought.
Certainly. I mean, so the point over the course of the campaign in highlighting that Trump was espousing something resembling a non-interventionist outlook was to point to the poverty of the discussion around foreign policy, given that the Democratic candidate could not credibly provide a counterweight to Trump in that regard. So that therefore made him the only option for people who craved some semblance of a non-interventionist foreign policy. And of course, he wasn't a reliable purveyor of that outlook, given his impulsivity and given his incoherence and given his belligerence. You know, I actually went back and checked something. Bill Scherer, who is one of the regular Blogging Heads contributors and does this kind of weekly show on politics, wrote himself that Trump actually exceeded Hillary Clinton in terms of espousing a non-interventionist outlook. Now, he was not in favor of Trump by any stretch, but that just seems to me to be the accurate portrayal of their comparative qualities. It wasn't an endorsement over another. It was just an assessment of their rhetoric and the positions that they had taken.
Sure, and I would concede the point that Trump, of course, did say certain things that were suggestive of a non-interventionist outlook over the course of the campaign. Of course, as you note, he also said many extremely violent things. For me, what made it so that he wasn't even worth considering that he might be the peace candidate, as it were, is that the temperament issue was so obviously a problem. Like he had this sort of, or the impulsivity, as you say. I mean, he had this sort of tendency to say wildly irresponsible things. And I know enough about foreign policy and sort of how it gets made to know that, you know, for the many, many sins of the DC foreign policy establishment, they do tend to be very, very careful about what they say. And there are probably a lot of situations that don't happen because of the care that is put into that. I thought in particular his comments about, you know, will we protect our NATO allies, maybe, or, you know, they should pay more or whatever, were extremely irresponsible. And I come at that not from the perspective that NATO expansion in the 90s or aughts was a good idea, or that the Baltics in an ideal world should be part of the alliance, but simply because they are, and the U.S. has made legal commitments to them. And for a president or potential president, I mean, I notice he's stopped saying this since the blob has gotten to him, but for a president or potential president to even suggest that there's any ambiguity about that commitment is to invite violence, which might then, you know, be met by more violence when the generals get upset about it or the media gets upset about it. So I felt that his manifest irresponsibility with words, which I don't think anyone could seriously deny has been present since, you know, he appeared on the national stage, completely disqualified him. And I say that as someone who would not have wanted Hillary Clinton's preferred foreign policy. But that's not...
Trump, in my estimation, was disqualified as well. I mean, that wouldn't preclude me from trying to accurately assess his foreign policy instincts. I mean, the issue with Trump is that over the course of the campaign, he just said so many words. I mean, his volume of word emission was so high that in order to accurately try to discern the correct analytical approach, in my opinion, was to try to discern instincts rather than to look at a particular utterance and say that is the hard and fast opinion that he's entered into the record. It's not to give him a pass on any individual utterance. It was just to say that, you know, given his unorthodoxy as a candidate, so the only candidate to be the major party nominee since 1940 who had not held elected office, and you need to sort of like schmodify the approach that you would take in analyzing his comments, as you would say to Hillary Clinton, who had been a senator and Secretary of State, who had like entered a formal of his positions into the record.
I sort of draw the opposite conclusion that his lack of a policy record made it that much more necessary to scrutinize every word that he was saying, and the words he was saying were often irresponsible, often inaccurate, often contradictory.
The point of that is often what he would say would be contradictory. Even in the same sentence, he could often contradict himself. So the idea was how do we best understand what political program he is presenting? And my solution to that was to try to, in totality, discern what his instincts and impulses are. And his instincts and impulses were in certain respects non-interventionist, in certain respects very bellicose and violent. That has generally been borne out over the course of his presidency. The attack on the Syrian government target 2 weeks ago now or so definitely was in contradiction with the instinct that he repeatedly evinced with respect to Syria. So I think that could be reasonably called a contradiction. But other than that, most of what he's done in the foreign policy realm have been pretty consistent with the impulses that he's articulated in a crude fashion over the course of the campaign.
Well, I mean, my other, I guess, concern, and this was the conclusion of my most recent Guardian piece, which I guess I'm plugging now, which was published last week, is that the incoherence, the constant contradictions themselves represent a national security risk. Like, you know, whether Trump had an extremely dovish foreign policy or an extremely hawkish foreign policy, you know, there are people who would argue either one of those might be dangerous, but I think the constant back and forth introduces an additional danger because, you know, and the sort of swapping around advisors with wildly different points of view, because how is any leader anywhere or even anyone in his defense department supposed to know, you know, what he's going to do at any given moment? And that creates a constant anxiety where, you know, one day we're gearing up for nuclear war with North Korea and the next day we're like, oh no, false alarm. And I worry terribly and earnestly, and I have since before he won the election, that is going to produce misunderstandings that could be absolutely catastrophic.
So although during the campaign I bristled at the overemphasis of Trump's temperamental qualities, I think it was always obvious, and this is something that I repeatedly acknowledge and warned about, was that his impulsivity or his inarticulateness could have pretty disastrous consequences in the foreign policy arena, because one kind of misconstrued joke or badly worded tweet could theoretically lead to some kind of diplomatic flare up and even potentially to some kind of cataclysmic military confrontation. So that was always a legitimate worry in my view. But that seemed to get drowned out during the campaign with concerns over his bombast and intemperate remarks in other areas. But in the foreign policy realm, it definitely was a legitimate concern. In terms of his overall incoherence, you know, that a danger of that, this is something that I acknowledged as well, and I'm assuming that, you know, you would agree with. I actually went and found a discussion that I did on YouTube with Rania Kolik on September 12th, which is that, you know, even though Trump is not a neocon, this is what I said then, Even though Trump is not a neoconservative, there is a potential that neocons would do as they usually do and try to insinuate themselves into power under his administration by promoting what are seen as mutually agreed upon goals. So Trump was definitely not a neoconservative ideologue, but given his overall malleability, it was always a very real potentiality that whatever ideological faction gained a leverage over him would be, in a sense, able to help shape his foreign policy program. And I think that has been at least preliminarily borne out. So that's what I have to say about that.
All right. Well, I guess in conclusion, I think we can agree that neocons and hawks more generally have gotten into Trump's inner circle at this point, with very scary implications. And I think we can agree that maybe Hillary Clinton wasn't the ideal candidate to take him on. And here's the part where I say, mostly just as a catchphrase, Bernie on. So with that, let's transition to the Russia issue. And spend just a little bit of time on that. So I've written a lot about this for mostly The Guardian, although I've been writing about Russia for years. And I guess, could you just briefly summarize your take on the allegations that that there are nefarious connections between the Russian government and the Trump campaign or Trump administration, and the media and Democratic Party reactions to those allegations?
Well, I think the allegations have spun totally out of control to create this narrative, which has now, in a sense, become unfalsifiable in the eyes of Democratic partisans. So the hallmark of a conspiracy theory is that no evidence could surface which would contradict the core tenets of the theory. And I think that is sort of how the Russia issue now is being processed. I mean, and what's so kind of maddening about it is that it arose in part due to purely partisan tactical reasons. The Hillary campaign seemed to wager last summer that the best way to win the election was to run against Trump as some kind of Putin stooge or puppet, you know, and she actually did use the word puppet. And the notion that Trump is directly controlled by the Kremlin, like a Manchurian candidate, that's an incredibly absurd view, I would say. And maybe not everybody who has a strong opinion about the truth of the Russia theory believes that version of it, but that's now become pretty widespread. So it's become almost a given in a lot of Democratic activist circles, including among Democrats in Congress, that Trump truly is has subverted the American government to further the interests of his benefactors in the Kremlin. And I think that is a view which is incredibly paranoid and sort of speaks to a fundamental irrationality that much of the media coverage of Trump spurred. And one of the ultimate points that I think I've always tried to emphasize when discussing this issue is that Trump, I think, definitely needs a rational opposition, and an opposition that can provide a counter to his most destructive tendencies. And the idea that the critique that was put at the forefront by Democrats and by liberals overall is that Trump was insufficiently aggressive toward Russia, I think is destructive in its own right and actually creates perverse incentives whereby Trump has a political impetus to demonstrate that he has not actually compromised by Putin or the Kremlin or what have you, and may actually be impelled to take rash military action to demonstrate that. And I think that might have been a factor in the strike in Syria.
So I think that fairly summarizes your points as I understand them. And I should say I'm not singling you out with what I'm about to say, because honestly, this is directed every bit as much at many of my friends on the left and on I think the general analysis you just laid out, sorry, one sec, the general analysis that you just laid out is in line with things that Glenn Greenwald has said, and that many, you know, very intelligent people on the left have said, and so I'm kind of responding to all of that, not just to you.
Well, I can only speak for myself, but have a go.
Well, sure. So the general critique I would have of what you just said, I agree with you, and in fact, it's literally right there in my most recent Guardian piece, that Trump is not a puppet or a Manchurian candidate, that he is obviously not under the direct control of the Russian government, and that there has been some hyperbolic and conspiratorial rhetoric to that effect. We could name some well-known, very amusing Twitter accounts, Louise Mensch, Eric Garland, and so on, who I think have gotten way too much attention from certain mainstream liberals, such as Joy-Ann Reid.
Just to be clear, just to interject very briefly, I mean, the Hillary Clinton campaign was a progenitor of that conspiratorial outlook.
That may be, but I want to here is what.
So it's not just. I mean, the point is, it's not just fringe people on Twitter. It's people with huge platforms and influence.
No, it absolutely is. And those fringe people, the only reason we know who they are is because they're getting attention from more mainstream people. That's absolutely true. Here is my critique. Nowhere in the analysis you generally laid out did you say anything about the actual issue of what is going on between Russia and the Trump administration. It didn't even factor in at all. And that's not just you, that's common. Let me finish. It's perfectly fair to say that there are people who are jumping to wild and speculative conclusions that are improbable or totally unfounded or reckless. That's true. And one can also make a political critique of the Democrats and their supporters and say that maybe they've given this issue too much attention at the expense of things that matter more, like jobs for the Rust Belt. But putting those critiques aside for a second, it's not that I disagree. I believe, and I believe there's quite a bit of evidence, that something extremely suspicious was going on between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. Now, I don't want to be irresponsible. I don't want to suggest wild conspiracy theories. At the same time, roughly half a dozen, off the top of my head, close Trump advisors on the campaign and in the administration, many of whom have since been sidelined precisely because of this, have given false or misleading statements about their contacts with the Russian government or have a very suspicious history with the Russian government. And there are a ton of unanswered questions. And even Glenn Greenwald, even though he's raised so much skepticism about this, has said that he supports an independent investigation, which we're not really getting. It's the one that we were supposed to have, which was supposed to be led by the Republican Congressman Devin Nunes, was compromised a few weeks ago because sources inside the White House, and I should say I used to know one of the people suspected of being one of those sources, Michael Ellis, extremely well, and I'm following this story with great interest, compromised him by sharing information with him, and the investigation seems to be going nowhere. And so it seems to me that without getting conspiratorial and without necessarily saying this is the only thing anyone needs to care about, there's a real problem here. And I suspect that there is a scandal here to rival, let's say, Watergate, and with a much larger international dimension than Watergate ever had. Watergate, keeping in mind, even though it brought down a president, was a pretty trivial matter, involving a couple of the administration's supporters illegally burglarizing the DNC headquarters and the president, knowing about it and covering it up. I mean, it seems pretty small ball, especially given the scale of his victory over George McGovern. All evidence that we have, and it is patchy and circumstantial, suggests that things were going on during the campaign that may have affected the outcome. This is not to let anyone on the Clinton campaign off the hook. This is not to say that Robbie Mook ran a good campaign or that Hillary shouldn't have visited Wisconsin. That's obviously true. But the campaign was close enough, even if that's Hillary's fault, that this may have had an effect on the outcome. And regardless, is deeply disturbing, I think, that there would be any role played by what I think is fair to characterize as a hostile foreign government in the U.S. political process, and that the Republican Party, and or the Trump campaign, which are really the same thing, would passively or actively accept assistance from a hostile foreign government to win an election. I believe that the American people need a lot of answers about that, that they're not getting. And I wonder if you think what I just said is completely ridiculous, or if you think there's any truth to it.
Well, first of all, I think it's definitely apparent that the Republicans who have been put in charge of overseeing the investigation in Congress have bungled it, even if they just created a public perception that suggests they're not in any way impartial enough to be put in a position of authority here. Actually, the congressman who I was covering this past week was Representative Mike Conaway, who just replaced Nunes as the Republican chair of the Russian Interference Investigation Committee here. So, I mean, that's pretty beyond doubt at this point.
What is beyond doubt that
just in terms of public perception, Nunes bungled his role in the investigation. So, I mean, and I've never had any principled aversion to investigation. I welcome investigation. My qualm has always been that the investigation would almost inevitably devolve into this kind of conspiracy theorizing and neo-McCarthyism. And I think that was on display at the recent Senate hearing when, for example, Thomas Ridd, who was testifying before the committee, said to solemn nods of approval from the senators that anybody who advances an argument or uses material, say, provisioned by WikiLeaks, is in a sense a agent of the Russian state. To me, that has a chilling effect. And well, given that the evidence that you outlined, and as you just conceded, it is circumstantial, there doesn't seem to be a legitimate basis for allowing this kind of paranoia and chilling to flourish. Because
but in fairness,
we need something a little more tangible than just circumstantial evidence, and people who are potentially connected to Trump meeting with people who happen to be Russian, and then that being cast as...
Hold on. I think that fundamentally misrepresents what's going on. Okay, the people we're describing include the person who was until briefly his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, his campaign chair, Paul Manafort. These are not... They actually include Jared Kushner, who lied or did not admit to various contacts with Russians when getting his rush security clearance, which a lot of people have concerns with. These are not peripheral figures. They include Roger Stone, who's been a close Trump confidant for decades. They include Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, who's in charge of all law enforcement.
This is like the connect the dots.
No, it's not. Hold on, Michael.
These dots are incredibly flimsy. Roger Stone. Roger Stone has gotten a huge PR boon from liberals desperate to believe that there's a smoking gun here because he DM'd this Lucifer character on Twitter, and that constitutes a Russian connection? That's absolutely preposterous.
Michael, let me finish my point here. You and I are not lawyers, okay? Our job is not to, defend our client, who I guess in this case would be either the Democratic Party on my side, which I don't really want to do, or the Trump administration on your side, which I assume you don't want to do. We're, journalists, and insofar as we're journalists, we're supposed to ask questions, not shut them down as ridiculous conspiracy theorizing. And I believe that to a clear-eyed observer, if we can put aside questions about whether the Democratic Party sucks at campaigning or not, because yes, it does, and if we can put aside questions about, McCarthyism, because I agree, there are some terms that are used, or, when people say the KGB when they mean the FSB, where they sound like idiots. But if we can put all that aside, there is a pretty troubling pattern, I would say, of contacts between inner circle, high level, extremely important Trump officials, and possibly the president himself.
What do you think is the most damning example?
Would it be
Flynn? Because I mean, Flynn is a smoking gun here, which a lot of people seem to think,
security advisor having a meeting with Vladimir Putin and losing his job in the Obama national security apparatus because nobody trusted him is troubling. Yes, I would say that Manafort's years of working with a government that is widely understood to have been financially backed and aligned with the Russian government, would create some troubling.
But Manafort did that in 2005, right? And that was prior to him and his business partner, Rick Davis, being involved in the John McCain campaign. So under this framework, he would have had to have been compromised by the Kremlin while he was involved in the John McCain campaign in 2008. I mean, is that what you are postulating here?
Yeah, I might be, actually. I mean, in fact, I think John McCain, for all he likes to posture against Russia, could do a lot more to explain why he endorsed a president who he himself has suggested has these ties. I'm not a huge fan of John McCain. But look,
but it kind of beggars belief that somebody working for John McCain.
I'm not going to rehash the dozens of examples of this that include the you're probably going to dismiss it as a joke, but the incident when the Republican nominee for president, you know, solicited Russian hackers. By the way, do you believe that Russian hackers were responsible for the DNC leaks, or do you think that is the likeliest scenario based on available evidence, or are you?
I think the available evidence shows that. I mean, there is very little of evidence that would demonstrate that. I mean, and the evidence that had been cited to conclude that the Democratic National Committee was in fact hacked by Russian state actors gets less reputable over time. I mean, I mean, it's possible. I've never discounted the possibility, but to make such an incendiary charge against, like you said, a hostile foreign power, and they are hostile in some respects, you actually need tangible evidence, and that evidence hasn't been produced after all this time.
Well, obviously, the Russian government is not going to concede that it does this. And however, at last count, I think, I mean, I'm not going to rehash every single story of a sketchy connection that's been reported by a reputable news outlet. I'm sure people are aware of many. Last I checked, there were, I think, seven foreign intelligence agencies that had serious concerns about this prior to the election that have come forward. And I don't want to place my trust in any particular intelligence service, including ours, for instance, because obviously they get things wrong or have nefarious agendas. But it does seem like there's an awful lot of smoke here. And it seems to me like a journalist's instinct should be to want to know more, especially given that Trump is now the most powerful person in the world. And I hope you would agree that the obligation of journalists is to speak truth to power. So there are
a lot of
are you satisfied with the Trump administration and the various officials who've, you know, had to resign for one reason or another? Or are you satisfied with their explanations for these contacts? Do you think there's an innocent explanation?
You could say there's smoke, and you know, maybe there's an appearance of smoke, but you know, as Mike Morrell himself said, and he was one of the originators of this whole narrative to begin with last summer, as he said, you know, there is smoke, but there is no fire. And believe you me, we've been looking for it, and we haven't found anything that actually proves the collusion thesis. So I think him making pretty consequential. And you say you don't want to get into the specifics of any of these contacts, but they just seem sketchy. I mean, that's because the specifics of each contact don't suggest that they lend credence to the underlying narrative, which is that Trump is compromised by the Russian state. I mean, that is what is...
Your use of the present tense there is interesting, because I don't believe right now that Trump's current foreign policy in Syria, for instance, is being guided by the interests of the Russian state. I think it's pretty... And I said so in my latest Guardian piece, that Trump did not personally collude, nor do I think that's really in Trump's nature, as best as we've seen it, to, you know... participate in an elaborate conspiracy for someone who doesn't, you know, even know how to keep his mouth shut about anything. I do think that some of the people who were advising him do have compromising relationships with Russia, which is not to say that they think of themselves as Russian agents. It's just to say that they've left themselves open in various ways. I also think it's suspicious that Trump picked a Secretary of State with no real government experience, who is the former CEO of ExxonMobil, a company which has huge lucrative contracts in Russia that were cut off by the sanctions that the Obama administration put in place after the annexation of Crimea. That said, I don't think that Trump's foreign policy is currently being guided by friendliness to Russia, although I think some of these people, including Tillerson, might have wanted it to be. I think that the reality is the blob, which has a hostile attitude toward Russia, you know, has won. against people.
But isn't it insidious that pursuing a policy of détente with Russia, and again, Trump's version of détente would necessarily be crude and inchoate. But if Trump were to have pursued that, he would have been automatically maligned by Democrats, so his most vocal critics, as doing things that proved his being compromised by Russia. So therefore, the incentive structure within which he's operating is totally perverted, and the most politically prudent tack for him to take is to do things that actually exhibit belligerence toward Russia.
I think you're giving Trump far too much credit for, you know, putting thought into what his foreign policy actually is or what his sort of long-term strategy. If Trump were, let's say Rand Paul had won the nomination, someone who I think is a rational person and a normal politician in some key respects, and who might well have pursued a more conciliatory approach to Russia than certainly Hillary Clinton would have. If that were the case, I don't think he would have done himself any favors by leaving himself open to the impression that, or let's say by surrounding himself by fringe advisors who found that they had to lie or misrepresent their contacts with the Russian state, as so many of Trump's advisors have done, and as Trump himself, I believe, has done.
On the sort of
only Nixon could go to China principle, that you don't make peace with an adversary or extend warm relations with an adversary by acting like they're not an adversary, and certainly not by lying in a way that raises constant and I think totally justifiable suspicion about what actually is going on. I also think is by doing what every other president has ever done, and we're saying this 2 days before tax day, and releasing his last decade or whatever of tax returns. That I think hopefully would put a lot of the conspiracy theories to rest, or at least set them back a lot. But of course, he has no intention of doing that, and I think that's also highly suspicious.
Okay, well, I think a lot of the people who have been implicated in these supposed sketchy meetings or contacts with Russian officials have the most simple explanation for what they have done seems to be me to be just kind of incompetence or clumsiness or political maladroitness, rather than an active effort to conceal a geopolitical conspiracy. And that is the interpretation that not just fringe people, mainstream Democrats seem to be alleging. So for that to be the prevailing view in the opposition party, I think, speaks to their fundamental irrationality. And in fact, it allows Trump to get away with things that probably could be counteracted by a rational opposition. So, for example, with Flynn, if he had met with the Russian ambassador and said, hold off, let's not escalate tensions, wait till we get into power and we'll revisit potentially these sanctions that were imposed on you at the last minute by the Obama administration in retaliation for the alleged hacking. Given the political climate, it would have been rational for Flynn not to represent those communications fully accurately, because meeting with a Russian official or even speaking to a Russian official could be cast in terms that inherently make it suspicious. So was it sloppiness? I mean, yeah, obviously it was sloppy because Flynn had to be terminated. But people leap from what seems to be an episode of incompetence or sloppiness or political miscalculation and construe that as evidence of the conspiracy that they've been longing for months to weave and to find the smoking gun for.
Well, I suspect the reality is that there is something, at least on the American side, on the Trump campaign side, something less than what we would call a conspiracy. Which is not to say no one did anything prosecutable. I have no idea because we don't know the facts. But I suspect that through the repeated, in many cases, career-long sloppiness or amorality or poor judgment of so many of the people Trump surrounded himself with, which in turn reflects on his own sloppiness and amorality, let's say, that Russia was able, I think, to attempt to wield some kind of influence and attempt to put its finger on the scale of the election. That is what I think happened. I think we need to know all the facts, but I think that we're not going to know all the facts because everyone, right up to Mitch McConnell, who there are allegations, blocked in a nonpartisan investigation into this before the election because he thought it would bias the election. I don't think there's any way we're going to get a fair investigation from these people, and thus I think it's incumbent on journalists to keep pushing the story. Now, I do think that people should stop retweeting the conspiracy theorists. I think people should stop jumping to wildly unfounded conclusions, but I do think there's a story here and that journalism, basic ethics of journalism demand that we keep asking for answers to that. But that
I don't disagree with that at all. I mean, I think answers are always desirable, and where they're appropriate to ask, are appropriate to ask, they should be asked.
I think it's very appropriate to keep asking. So I think we should probably start to wrap this up, but is there anything else just general about anything we've discussed that or anything you want to ask me before we go?
I mean, and this isn't a general point, but I think it's plausible, certainly, that some Trump functionaries, like, I don't know, this guy Carter Page, who just seems like a total incompetent dupe. It's very well that, you know, because of some act that he took, some action that he might well face prosecution. And he's coming, he came under scrutiny as a result of this FBI inquiry. But I think it would be wrong to frame a Trump official who didn't properly register or who had some contact which was not legally above board, I think it would be wrong to kind of extrapolate from that that Trump equals Putin agent thesis has been vindicated. Well, if anything, what would be vindicated is that what would be vindicated
I don't think
the functionaries around Trump were not behaving in a fully above board manner, which wouldn't be in any sense unique to Trump. That seems to be commonplace among political operatives.
I think we can agree that the absolute most generous read is that this is a deeply clumsy, incompetent administration with poor judgment. And maybe we should leave it on that. Michael, it's been good to talk to you. I think we've proven what Bob Wright always says, that it's possible for people who've been antagonistic to have a civil discourse on this site. So, but I'll let you have the last word.
I will just affirm what you just said there. And if you still feel the urge to troll in the future, don't let this productive conversation be an impediment to that.
Oh, believe me, I wasn't planning on it. It was great to talk to you, Mike.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.